Imagine for a second that you are playing God. You have two separate crystals in your hands. Let's say two grains of copper or steel. And you are going to just smash them together to create a solid interface.
Okay, that's a pretty violent start to the morning.
Well, sometimes science requires a little force.
Yeah.
But here is the thing. These aren't like two balls of clay that just smush together into a blob. They are crystals. They have internal structure.
Right, highly ordered.
Exactly. Rows of atoms lined up in very specific directions. And when you smash them together, those rows, they almost never line up perfectly.
No, they don't. You have an orientation mismatch. One is tilted, the other is twisted, or maybe both. The atoms are facing completely different ways.
Right. So my intuition tells me that the boundary where they meet should be just a total disaster zone, a chaotic, jagged car crash of atoms with no rhyme or reason. Just a mess.
And that is a really common intuitive assumption. If you zoom out, it certainly looks like a crack or a messy seam in the material.
But, and this is exactly why we are here today, if you zoom in, like way in, down to the atomic level, that chaotic mess isn't chaotic at all, is it?
No, it's really not. It is surprisingly, almost shockingly organized. It turns out that even in the middle of that so-called car crash, nature is desperately trying to find a pattern.
Yeah.
It's using incredibly advanced geometry to stitch those two grains together.
And that is what we are unpacking today. We are doing a deep dive into Chapter 13, which is simply titled Interfaces, from the heavy hitter text Geometry of Crystals, Polycrystals, and Phase Transformations by HKDH Padesia.
It is an absolute classic in the field, and this chapter specifically is it's really a masterclass in understanding misfit.
Misfit. I actually love that term in physics. It sounds so emotional for a rock. Like these atoms are just misunderstood misfits.
I can assure you it is strictly geometrical here. We are looking at how materials handle the error when things just don't fit. We're going to talk about how nature creates good fit out of bad, the magic of coincidence site lattices, and some really mind-bending geometric ideas like the O lattice.
By the end of this deep dive, I want you, the listener, to be able to look at a crack or a grain boundary in a piece of metal and see it not as a mistake, but as a map.
That's the perfect goal, a map of atomic compromises.
So let's start with the basic problem, the problem of connection, as I've been calling it. You have grain A and grain B. They meet, their atomic grids are rotated relative to each other, they do not line up. What happens immediately at that physical boundary?
Well, the atoms right at the interface are essentially in a crisis. They want to belong to the perfect crystal lattice of grain A, but they also feel the chemical pull of grain B,
Right.
so they're pulled out of their ideal positions. This displacement creates energy specifically, stored elastic strain energy. The material absolutely hates this. It wants to minimize that energy immediately.
Nature is lazy. It always wants the lowest energy state.
I prefer to say nature is highly efficient. So the text distinguishes between two primary ways the material handles this geometrical crisis. You have the incoherent boundary and the semi-coherent boundary.
Let's start with the bad news first.
Yeah.
The incoherent boundary.
This is the car crash scenario you mentioned earlier. This happens when the misfit is just too massive. The angle of rotation is too high, or the crystal structures are just entirely too different. The geometric error is so large that the material basically gives up on finding a neat pattern.
So there really is no structure, it's just random atoms.
Well, not entirely random, but the text explicitly says the structure becomes difficult to interpret physically. If you try to move this boundary, like if the grain is growing during heating, the atoms have to shuffle across in a haphazard way. It's uncoordinated. It's a mess.
Okay, so that's the boring, chaotic version. But the semi-coherent boundary, that sounds like where the magic actually happens.
Exactly. Semi-coherent means the material has found a clever compromise. Instead of the whole boundary being a high-energy mess, the material localizes the error. It gathers up all the bad fit and squishes it into tiny specific lines.
And these lines are the dislocations.
Yes. Think of it like laying a carpet that's slightly too big for the room. You can't make it lie completely flat everywhere. So what do?
I make a wrinkle in the carpet.
You make a wrinkle. That wrinkle is the dislocation. But notice what happens when you do that. By making that one distinct wrinkle, the rest of the carpet on either side of it can lie perfectly flat.
Right. I sacrifice one tiny strip of bad fit to get huge patches of perfect fit.
That is exactly what a semi-coherent boundary is. It's large patches of perfect coherent crystal separated by a periodic array of dislocations, the wrinkles that contain all the geometric misfit.
So the dislocation isn't just a defect in the negative sense, it's a solution. It's the material saying, I'll take the hit here so everything else can be perfect.
Precisely. It's a brilliant coping mechanism for the crystal lattice.
Now the text gets into how we actually measure this misfit mathematically. It introduces a tool called the Burger circuit. And I have to be honest, reading the formal definition of this can be a bit dry. It's usually described as going up, down, left, right, atom by atom. Can we visualize this a bit better for someone listening on their commute?
Sure, we can do that. Imagine you are walking in a city with a perfect, pristine grid layout. New York City, maybe. You start at an intersection. Let's call it a coffee shop. You walk 10 blocks north, 10 blocks east, 10 blocks south, and 10 blocks west. Where are you?
I'm back at the coffee shop, hopefully with a fresh cup.
Right, that's your perfect crystal. The loop closes perfectly. Now imagine you do the exact same thing, but a massive earthquake has shifted the ground somewhere inside your walking loop. There's a fault line, a dislocation running right through the blocks you just walked around.
Okay, so the ground has physically shifted.
You walk 10 north, 10 east, 10 south, 10 west. But because the grid was distorted by that fault line, you do not end up at the coffee shop where you started. You end up, say, half a block away.
I'm lost. There's a gap between my start and my end point.
That gap is what we call the closure failure. In physics, we call that mathematical vector, the precise arrow pointing from where you ended to where you started. The Burgers vector.
And that vector represents the earthquake.
It quantifies the misfit. It tells you exactly how much the lattice is discontinuous. And in our grain boundary, the total misfit, all the bad fit between the two grains, can be summed up as a net Burgers vector.
So we can actually assign a hard number and a spatial direction to the bad fit. It's not just, oh, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit by this much in this specific direction.
Precisely. And the geometric game of the grain boundary is basically asking, how do I break this big total Burgers vector down into smaller, manageable arrays of little dislocations?
The text lists a couple of ways the material does this in practice.
Yeah.
It mentions tilt boundaries and twist boundaries. I feel like I'm in a dance class.
It is a bit of a geometric dance. A tilt boundary is exactly what it sounds like. Imagine taking a thick deck of cards and bending it. You're rotating the crystal around an axis that is parallel to the boundary plane.
Like opening a book slightly.
Sort of, yes. And to accommodate that opening, that wedge shape, you need a row of edge dislocations. It's literally like inserting extra half planes of atoms, like shoving extra cards into the deck on one side to fan it out.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The wedge shape is filled by the extra atoms. And the twist boundary.
Imagine two wooden blocks sitting flat on top of each other. Now rotate the top block like you're unscrewing the lid of a jar. That's a twist.
And how does nature handle that? Because you can't just shove a wedge of extra atoms into a twist.
No, you can't. For a twist boundary, you typically get a grid of screw dislocations. They look like a crosshatch pattern, like a screen door. But, and here is a really lovely, subtle detail from Padacia. He notes that in physical reality, they aren't pure screw dislocations.
Why not? The textbook mathematical model says they should be.
Because physical reality is messy. These dislocation lines form a grid, which means they have to cross each other. And where they intersect, they interact and create jogs.
Jogs, like they bump into each other in Kink.
Yes, little atomic steps. And those jogs force the screw dislocation to suddenly have a tiny edge component. It's a great reminder that even our cleanest geometric models have to bend to the will of actual atomic interactions.
So we have these wrinkles, these dislocations, holding the boundary together. But sometimes the rotation hits a sweet spot, doesn't it?
Yes, the magic angles.
The text calls this the coincidence site lattice, or CSL. Reading about this felt like looking through a kaleidoscope to me.
That's a fantastic image. Imagine you have two identical wire meshes, crystal A and crystal B. And you overlay them. Usually the wires just crisscross randomly and create a visual mess. But if you rotate one mesh.
Yes, right.
Exactly. You rotate it just right. Suddenly, click.
A bunch of the corners line up perfectly.
Yes. A specific fraction of the lattice points from crystal A land exactly on top of the lattice points for crystal B.
And those matching points form a brand new grid of their own.
Correct. That super grid of matching points is the coincidence site lattice.
This is where we see that Greek letter sigma throughout the chapter. I see sigma 3, sigma 5. What is that actually telling me?
Sigma is essentially the reciprocal density of those matching points. In plain English, if you have a sigma 3 boundary, it means exactly one out of every three lattice sites is a perfect match.
One and three?
Yeah.
That seems incredibly frequent.
It is huge. It implies a very, very high degree of order at the boundary. And in thermodynamics, order usually translates to low energy, stability. A sigma-3 boundary is a very happy, stable interface.
The text gives a specific real-world example of this in austenite.
Yes. If you take an austenite crystal and rotate it 180 degrees, flip it over, basically around the 112 crystallographic axis, you get a perfect sigma-3 coincidence site lattice. We usually call this a twin boundary.
A twin.
Because the atomic structure on one side is a literal mirror image of the other. It's not just a random neighbor, it's a reflection. These twin boundaries are incredibly stable and very common in metals like copper and stainless steel.
Okay, so CSL explains why some boundaries are super strong and have very low energy. But then Badeshia throws a wrench in the gears. He starts talking about hard atoms.
Yes, the physical reality check.
Because the CSL is a purely geometric concept. It assumes lattice points are just dots. Zero dimension. But atoms are fat. They take up physical space. They have electron clouds.
And electron clouds fiercely repel each other.
Right. So if the geometry says, okay, atoms overlap perfectly right here, the actual atoms might say, no thanks, you're standing on my foot.
Exactly. If the atoms at the mathematical interface are squeezed too close together, the local energy spikes. So the crystals might spontaneously shift. They might slide just a tiny fraction of a nanometer, what we call a rigid body translation, just to relieve that atomic crowding.
But wait, if they slide, doesn't that completely ruin the CSL? The points don't overlap anymore.
Technically, yes. It destroys the exact point-to-point mathematical coincidence. The absolute perfection is lost.
So why do we even teach CSL if the physical atoms ruin it immediately? That seems totally counterproductive.
Because the periodicity remains. The pattern is still there, even if the registration is slightly off. Think of it like a strict formation of marching soldiers. They might all take a half step to the left to avoid a puddle. So they aren't standing on their painted markers on the ground anymore, but they are still in perfect formation relative to each other.
Oh, I see. The pattern holds, even if the absolute position shifts in space.
Precisely. The hard atom effect shifts the origin, but it doesn't destroy the geometric relationship between the two grains.
Okay, so CSL handles the lattice points, the soldiers, but the text introduces another theory that goes even deeper, the O-lattice theory. This sounded to me like CSL on steroids.
It is, because CSL only looks at the lattice points, the corners of the grid, but a crystal is mostly empty space, right? What about the space between the atoms?
Right. An atom doesn't have to sit exactly on a corner to match.
This was the brilliant insight of Walter Bulman. He developed the O-lattice theory. He asked, where are all the points of perfect fit? Not just the lattice corners, but anywhere within the unit cell.
So if I'm standing 25% of the way across the room in crystal A.
He looks for the mathematical spot that corresponds exactly to 25% of the way across the room in crystal B. If those two abstract spots coincide spatially, that is an O-point.
Then O-point. A point of perfect origin.
Yes. The O-lattice is the continuous mathematical collection of all these perfect points. But here is the real kicker. It's not just about finding the good spots. It's about defining the walls between them.
The cell walls. The text made a really big deal about these cell walls.
Imagine a honeycomb. The empty space in the exact center of each hexagon, that's your O-point. That's where the fit is perfect. But as you move radially away from the center, the fit gets worse and worse until you hit the physical wax wall separating the cells.
And that wall is the exact point of maximum misfit.
Exactly. And physically, what do you think resides at those lines of maximum misfit?
That's where the actual dislocations go.
Bingo. The O-lattice theory is incredibly powerful because if you calculate where these mathematical cell walls are, you are essentially predicting exactly where the physical dislocations will sit in the real metal.
That is so cool. It connects the totally abstract continuous math directly to the discrete physical defect.
It's a map of the atomic battlefield. It tells you exactly where the trenches will be dug.
Now, we need to add one final layer of complexity to this map. We talked about sigma-3, that perfect twin fit, but nature is rarely absolutely perfect. What happens if the two crystals are almost at a sigma-3 orientation, but they are twisted just a tiny fraction of a degree off?
Ah, the deviation from coincidence. This is where things get really intricate. If you are very close to a perfect CSL fit, the material doesn't want to just act like two random grains. It desperately wants to act like a twin.
It tries to force the fit.
Yes. It will deform slightly to maintain that perfect sigma-3 pattern over large coherent areas. But to mathematically compensate for that slight angular error, it has to introduce a brand new set of defects. We call these secondary dislocations.
Secondary, as opposed to what?
Primary dislocations are what we talked about earlier, fixing the gross misfit between two completely random crystals. Secondary dislocations fix the tiny misfit relative to a perfect CSL. They're essentially corrections to the correction.
It's like, okay, let's go back to the carpet. I have a badly wrinkled carpet. Those are primary dislocations. But then I try to pull and straighten those big wrinkles, and I end up with tiny little micro creases in the fabric itself.
That's a very decent analogy, and describing these tiny secondary dislocations mathematically requires what I think is the most fearsome acronym in the whole chapter, the DSC lattice.
Yes, the displacement shift, complete lattice. It sounds like a sci-fi drive engine. Engage the DSC drive.
It is quite a mouthful. The formal definition is that it's the coarsest lattice that contains the lattice points of both crystals.
Okay, you have to explain that to me like I'm five. What does coarsest lattice containing both actually mean?
Imagine you have two completely different grids overlaying each other. The DSC lattice is like a super fine graph paper underneath them both. It's a grid so fine that every single point from crystal A and every single point from crystal B falls perfectly on one of the tiny grid lines of that graph paper.
So it's just the common denominator.
Exactly. It's the lowest common denominator of the two intersecting crystals. And because it is the common denominator, the Burgers vectors for these secondary dislocations, the tiny correction vectors, are drawn directly from this DSC lattice.
The text mentioned something strange about these DSC vectors, though. They're absolutely tiny.
Very tiny. Often much, much smaller than the normal space between atoms in a regular crystal.
But even though they are mathematically tiny, they have a massive physical effect on the boundary. The step.
Oh, I love this part. This is where abstract geometry becomes actual physical topography.
Topography. Like a topographic map of a mountain.
Like a literal staircase.
Yeah.
When a secondary dislocation moves along the boundary or simply exists statically there, it is directly associated with a physical step in the interface.
Wait, so the boundary isn't a flat plane anymore?
No, it's not. Figure 13.4 in the text shows this beautifully. If you have these secondary dislocations present, the grain boundary physically steps up and down, has distinct ledges.
Why? Why does it step?
Because the DSC vector literally shifts the geometric origin of the coincidence pattern. To keep the CSL pattern perfectly matched after that shift, the physical boundary plane has to jump up or down a level.
So these invisible subatomic mathematical vectors result in jagged physical ledges that you could actually see under an electron microscope.
If your microscope had the right resolution, yes. The math creates the physical shape. It's not just an internal lattice distortion. It creates actual topological height.
That is wildly deterministic. It makes it sound like if we just know the initial angles, we can perfectly predict everything about the material. But Badesia doesn't let us off that easy. He ends the chapter with a section called Difficulties and Ambiguities.
Science is never a completely closed book.
One of the big ambiguities is the choice problem, the transformation strain. This part actually confused me a bit.
It's a bit of a philosophical headache, honestly. Thermodynamics tells us about the start state, crystal A, and the end state, crystal B. But we didn't watch the movie of how it formed. We don't know the exact path it took to get from A to B.
We just see the final solid result.
Right. And the mathematical problem is there might be two or three completely different ways to geometrically describe that exact same change.
The text used the tilt boundary as an example for this.
Yes. You look at a finished tilt boundary. You could describe it mathematically and say, oh, this crystal just rotated rigidly. It just spun around its axis. That's one totally valid mathematical description.
Simple, rigid rotation. Got it.
But you could also look at that exact same boundary and say, no, this crystal didn't spin at all. It was sheared. Imagine pushing a deck of cards from the side so the whole deck leans over diagonally. That's a shear.
And the math works out perfectly for both scenarios.
The final crystallographic orientation is identical. The math works perfectly for both. But the underlying physics is fundamentally different. If it was a shear-like in a mechanical twin caused by an impact, you would actually see the macroscopic shape of the metal change. You'd get surface relief, a physical bump on the metal.
But if it was just a rotation?
Like an annealing twin that just peacefully grows during heating in a furnace, there is no macroscopic shape change. So physically, we know they're entirely different mechanisms. But geometrically, if you just look at the atomic interface, it looks exactly the same.
So which math do we use to model it?
We have to make a choice. And that choice is inherently ambiguous. It implies that just looking at the final structure isn't enough. You really need to know the historical path of how it formed.
That seamlessly leads to the other issue the text brings up, which is non-uniqueness.
A very related problem. We said earlier that we mathematically break the big total misfit vector down into neat dislocation arrays. But mathematically speaking, there are infinite ways to slice up a vector.
Infinite.
Sure. I can make the number 10 by adding 5 and 5 or 6 and 4 or 1 and 1 and 1.
So how does nature actually decide which specific dislocation array to use in the real metal?
We generally fall back on the assumption that nature is lazy. It picks the mathematical solution that results in the lowest elastic strain energy, the easiest physical path.
But the text specifically warns us that isn't always guaranteed to be true.
No, it's not. Sometimes, atomistic simulations where we model every single atom's interaction in a supercomputer show us atomic structures that are completely different from what our simple geometric theories predict. They suggest that real boundaries might actually be made of discrete structural units.
Structural units, what are those?
Little repeating 3D clusters of atoms, think of them like atomic polyhedra. And in this view, secondary dislocations aren't just abstract math vectors. They are just physical places where the type of atomic cluster switches from one shape to another.
So we have this grand, elegant geometric theory, the CSL, the DSE lattice. And then on the other side, we have the gritty, bumpy reality of actual atomic clusters.
And we are currently trying to bridge that gap. That is the bleeding edge of materials science. The continuous geometry is the map, but the discrete structural units are the actual terrain.
It's incredibly impressive how far we've come in just a short time today. We literally started with smashing two crystals together and expecting a chaotic mess.
And we found a deeply hidden mathematical world instead.
We found that the misfit isn't random at all. It's organized into specific dislocations. The wrinkles in the rug.
We found the magic angles, the coincidence site lattice, where the crystals lock into a perfect twin embrace.
We use the O lattice theory to continuously map the cell walls of maximum bad fit.
And we use the DSC lattice to find the tiny subatomic steps and ledges that dictate the actual physical topography of the boundary plane.
It really transforms the way you look at a piece of everyday metal. It's not just a boring chunk of gray stuff. It's a highly active battlefield of geometry. It's millions of tiny distinct grains, all constantly trying to negotiate their complex borders with their neighbors.
And you have to realize that negotiation matters immensely. These atomic interfaces completely dictate how the macroscopic material breaks, how it conducts electricity, how fast it corrodes in seawater.
And if the atomic negotiation fails?
The bridge falls down, or the jet turbine blade snaps mid-flight. The macroscopic, real-world strength of our infrastructure is entirely dependent on this microscopic, hidden geometry.
Before we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a thought that's been nagging me ever since we talked about the hard atoms.
The electron cloud repulsion issue.
Right. We said that because real atoms repel each other, they might physically shift slightly, destroying the exact mathematical points of the coincidence site lattice.
Yes, the rigid body translation.
So if those perfect mathematical points don't actually exist in physical reality because real-world physics gets in the way, is the coincidence site lattice even real? Or is it just a highly useful human fiction we invented to make the math easier?
That is exactly the provocative question you should be asking. Is the continuous geometry actually driving the physical reality, or are we just obsessively drawing lines on a map that nature itself doesn't even see? And furthermore, does the fact that the interface structure is mathematically ambiguous mean that a material literally holds the memory of how it was manufactured, permanently locked into those tiny, irreversible atomic choices?
Does the crystal remember its own past?
It just might.
Something for you to mull over the next time you casually look at a steel beam or a copper wire. We'll be back next time with another deep dive. Until then, watch your boundaries.